you have to reach out to your friends who think they are making it good and get them to understand that they, as well as you and I, cannot be free in America or anywhere else where there is capitalism and imperialism until we can get people to recognize that they themselves have to make the struggle and have to make the fight for freedom every day in the year, every year, until they win it.
Hello, and welcome back to Religion and Justice. I'm Gabby Lisi, and today we have a unique episode for you. Unfortunately, at the time of recording, George and I were both under the weather, so you won't get to hear our usual banter, but the conversation ahead promises to be as engaging as ever. This episode is a part of our special grant series, where we explore the profound intersections of religion, justice, and history. Today's episode, hosted by Assistant Director of Wendland Cook and the Director of Online Learning at Vanderbilt Divinity School, Aaron Stauffer, is a deep dive into the social gospel in the South. This grant series aims to uncover the untold stories connecting the past with the present. We are thrilled to have you join us on this journey through history, guided by our esteemed guests and experts in the field. Joining Aaron Stauffer today in this exploration are two distinguished guests, Eric S. Gelman, whose research delves into working class and urban life, visual culture, and comparative social movements in modern American history. He's also joined by Jared Roll, a professor of history at the University of Mississippi, specializing in the working class experience and popular economic thought, particularly in rural America. Together, they'll unravel the intricate threads of the social gospel in the South, focusing on figures such as Ed Whitfield and Claude Williams. This episode explores how justice and radical organizing were deeply rooted in religion for these historical figures.
Well, Jared and Eric, thank you so much for being here. Friends, Eric is a professor of history at University of North Carolina and the College of Arts and Sciences of History. Jared Roll is a professor of history at the University of Mississippi. They have both written long, wonderful, deep, probing books on the topic that we're going to talk about today, the social gospel in the South. We were talking a little bit earlier. We will try and stay out of the weeds as much as possible here. We're going to try and keep things high level intro just to make sure that we are reaching the masses and not just nerding out on history. So let's begin with ourselves, though. Jared and Eric, what compelled you to write these books on the social gospel in the South, on labor history in the South, on radical movements, radical labor movements at all? Eric, we can start with you. How about that? You want to go for it?
Sure. I think what compelled us to eventually write this book was a conversation that Jared and I had in a bar in Evanston, Illinois in graduate school. We kept on, in our individual research, coming across one person who's one of the key characters in this book, Owen Whitfield, an African-American who was born without a birth certificate in Mississippi at the end of the 19th century and who grew up in the South and then eventually gets an audience, a private audience with President Roosevelt. He would show up in my research. I was researching mostly urban African-American history and social movement history in the 1930s. And he would show up in Jared's research because Jared was researching rural social movement protests in the Boot Heel and other places in Missouri. We realized that the categories that historians usually use were insufficient. And then I knew part of the story, Jared knew part of the story, and it was then a matter of trying to collaborate to figure out who was this person of great faith and how did he try to apply religion across these decades of the 20th century and make such an impact given that he was such an unimportant person when he was born, right? That he wasn't even registered as a citizen, as a human being, right? And so it's trying to figure out this remarkable story about religion and activism in the South from the 1920s, basically, teens and 20s, all the way up through the peak of this kind of social gospel, interracial activity in the 30s and 40s.
Yeah, and we wrote an article first just about Whitfield. As graduate students, we got published in the Journal of Southern History and then thought, wait a minute, this is not the whole story. There's this other character named Claude Williams, who's a white preacher from Western Tennessee who grew up in very similar background to Whitfield, whose career mirrored Whitfield's in many ways, and as our research showed, featured deep collaboration between them in the 1930s and 1940s, particularly around an organization that they co-created called the People's Institute of Applied Religion. That became the basis for then the book.
That's right. And I love, Eric, how you talked about how it's, I can almost kind of see, or at least I would imagine you two struggling against the preconceived ways that history told the story about Whitfield and Williams, about who these figures are, what really mattered, what was the primary motivation. I can kind of see you struggling against the restrictions of those categories and searching for new ways to talk about what's really going on. One of those was religion, right? One of those was this motivating factor of religion that it seems that people would either explain it away in various ways or they would overemphasize it. So how did you, am I following you right? Is that, is religion is sort of what, how did you go about redefining what it is that Williams and Whitfield were up to?
I'll go first on that one. From looking at these two historical actors from the perspective of labor unions, of radical social movements in the 1930s, historians often talked about the use of religion, you know, just a tool, just a tactic to get at more material-based, economic-based political ideas. But what we found in these stories is actually the religion mattered, and the religion is central to understanding the motivations of both of them and their spouses, Zella Whitfield and Joyce Williams, who are really equal partners in the story with them. And so their pursuit of their faith and their application of their faith to the economic social crisis of the 1930s and 1940s, drawing on the deep experience they had as people who grew up impoverished in the rural South, Whitfield under the heel of Jim Crow, that is what really carried them through and motivated their economic and political actions, trying to realize their Christian faith and what they thought it meant about freedom, justice, enjoying the bounty of creation in this dynamic and chaotic period.
And I would just add to that, that, you know, labor historians have not been very good at understanding religion. And I mean, Jared underscored that point, and I would just elaborate by saying that, you know, some of these labor historians come from a very Marxist perspective, and for them, religion is a distraction, it's a confusion, it's something that deters people from a class consciousness. And here we were finding more and more evidence of this network of religious radicals who were actually fusing ideas of Marxism with Christianity and how powerful that was. And also, I think that allowed us to get to a deeper emotional level of those characters, to understand their way of life, their culture, and also fundamentally, like, why do you get involved in a social movement that is so irrational to get involved in radical social movements and sustain them? There's no logical reason, right, to do this, but except faith, right? Except having this leap of faith to do things, to put yourself in the way of violence and almost get lynched, to basically take a vow of poverty in many of the things that Claude Williams and Owen Whitfield and the people around them engaged in. Were, you know, they were not making any money. They were drummed out of various communities. They weren't good institutionalists in terms of like being parts of larger organizations, maybe to a fault, right? But it turns out that religion, in analyzing their faith and how it changed over time and through experience, was the key to unlocking this larger working class world.
I love how you just explained that, Eric, how you're talking about sort of tapping into their emotional world and who they are and what they really cared about. Because it is, you know, reading, you know, going through your book, right, The Gospel of the Working Class, and just you come across story after story where I think, okay, Whitfield is finally going to throw in. They're going to go back and they're just going to, this is not a success story, I guess. I mean, in some senses it is, right? And I think the Southern Tenants Farmers Union is just a fascinating playing field for thinking about what political and economic success and wins look like in certain organizing conditions. I was talking with a colleague of mine about the role of congregations and churches in the Southern Tenants Farmer Union the other day. And she said to me, you know, I'm glad you're thinking about writing about this, Aaron, because better you than me, because I cannot understand how would this end up well, right? Under what circumstances Can organizing for radical movements in those times and places actually be efficacious and actually win? And there are huge wins. Like Whitfield does some amazing things and Williams, but at the end, it sort of eats itself. I've been kind of like talking around the story of their org. So, but let's get right at it. What do they do? What's their fight? What are the organizations? Let's give a sort of Cliff Notes version here of what their fights are and who they're fighting with and against.
In short, they are trying to empower the most impoverished, marginalized, oppressed people in the United States in the middle of the 20th century to combat both their economic exploitation, particularly in the rural South. We're talking about tenant farmers, sharecroppers, casual seasonal wage laborers, but also to challenge the oppression of Jim Crow and racial terror from Southern authorities. That is popular among the working people of the South, but not just the South. Both Williams and Whitfield and their collaboration has a career outside of the region. Williams, for instance, is the Presbyterian Church's wartime minister to labor in Detroit, the very arsenal of democracy, which of course is full of migrants from the South. So they work through a number of organizations. Whitfield, for a time, is a member of the Universal Negro Improvement Association, Marcus Garvey's worldwide Black nationalist movement. They meet in the context of the Southern Tenant Farmers Union in Eastern Arkansas and Southeast Missouri, and then move into working for the CIO and its agribusiness union, organizing across the region, truly across the country in the 1940s, and then their own collaboration in the People's Institute of Applied Religion.
So what are those fights about? Some of them are, it's not just around agricultural policy. It's also around housing. It's also around, so it's multifaceted here, which I think is really, really fascinating, right? Can we talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I mean, in the early 1930s, I would say what radicalizes both of them is literal hunger. And the book actually starts off with Claude Williams preaching at the burial of a child who died of malnutrition, right? And so it starts with that, but then it grows into a kind of worldview that believes in justice for poor people. And you can think of all the Bible passages that they would cite that would emphasize that. Also, economic and racial justice. They see labor unions in particular as vehicles for liberation, but they never get away from the basic religious conviction, right? That poor people can find a kind of radical Jesus as Jesus lived, right? And act in that way to sort of heal the earth and solve these larger problems and confront the authorities who are oppressing so many people in the country in the 1930s and 40s. And it's a remarkable journey for Whitfield and Williams. I mean, just one example would be thinking about race. Whitfield in the 1920s is preaching in the Boot Heel of Missouri, and he's a Garveyite. When he first hears about Claude Williams possibly coming to his church, he says, "What does that white Peckerwood have to say to me?" Right. And then he actually hears Williams and says, "Oh, wait a minute." You know, he has to start to rethink his philosophy, right? Williams similarly, like, has all kinds of problems growing up in, you know, rural Tennessee. He inculcates Jim Crow and the ideas of racial superiority. And it takes him a lot of experiential learning and then relationships with people like Whitfield to become an anti-racist in the Jim Crow South. It's a really powerful revolutionary thing. And to sort of underscore one thing that Jared was talking about is like the fact that Whitfield and Williams and their group, the People's Institute of Applied Religion, did not give up on the kinds of people that liberals gave up on, right? Oh, these are rednecks. These are, you know, illiterate religious, you know, dupes or et cetera. You know, these people are undereducated, whatever. They thought that all of those people were redeemable, right? And that they brought them these charts through the People's Institute of Applied Religion. They held these meetings. And then you get examples like A.L. Campbell, who is this free will Baptist minister at rural Arkansas, member of the Ku Klux Klan, who hears Williams's message in 1941 in St. Louis at one of these PIAR retreats. He comes home with some of the charts, and then he faces retribution. He's homeless for a time, living on the Arkansas River, but he is happy because he's found this applied religion idea and it suits him, right? And so he does a 180 from a Klan member to this progressive Baptist applied religion minister, right? And it's just remarkable. It makes me think of our current moment, you know, where you hear a lot of liberals say, oh, these rural people, you know, they vote against their interests, they get duped by this and that. And it's like, well, who's trying to reach them and on what terms?
And just to follow up, I mean, they, you know, they achieve amazing successes, right? It's not just lonely prophets wandering out and reaching people, but cotton picking strikes, the 1939 roadside demonstration in Southeast Missouri, where Whitfield and community leaders organize over 1,500 people who camp out on Highway 61 in Southeast Missouri to protest evictions under New Deal agricultural law, helping workers win National Labor Relations Board elections in places like Memphis, Winston-Salem, North Carolina. So, you know, realizing material gains in the workplace, as well as raising their voice in protest, legal inequity.
That's really true. I don't want to make the story as in like there weren't real and important successes. I think part of the reason that I'm left with the impression of the flavor mouth that this is their organizing in some of the harshest and most difficult circumstances is really thinking about the relationships that make that organizing possible in the first place. We're thinking about, you know, at the Woodland Cook Program, we're thinking about Williams specifically because he, you know, met Howard Kester and Albert Taylor, two other social gospel figures, along with Don West and Ward Rogers. Kester, Williams, even West, too, were a part of the Southern Tenants Farmers Union. But it becomes, you know, so after the story that I tell in my head about this is that, you know, Williams is this ordained Cumberland Presbyterian minister, a little more Pentecostal, sort of on fire with the Spirit, right? Is sort of ministering in some churches in outside of Nashville. Goes to Vanderbilt, meets Kester and meets Taylor, and kind of gets a sense of this applied religion a little bit more. That doesn't make sense to talk about Jesus and without thinking about the social circumstances, about what applied religion actually looks like. That then sets both he and Kester off on Kester had been going on this for a while too, anti-lynching investigators with the NAACP, working with the YMCA, Fellowship of Reconciliation. So both of them have these long histories of being already committed to the work here. But 10 years later, you've got this firestorm of conflict where Williams is at the center of it, right? And Kester then stabs him in the back and essentially gets him kicked out of the Southern Tenants Farmers Union. And all of that sort of revolving around seems to me less to do actually with Williams's organizing and more to do red baiting, more to do with the fact that of what's going on in the environments, of what it means to organize with communists or to and how people are walking these identity lines in ways that actually end up fracturing the movement itself so that the left eats itself. That's part of what I'm thinking about is that it's not just that they're organizing in really harsh circumstances in the boot heel of Missouri. Jared, in one of your other books, you're talking, you just have this story of what the jobs were like there for clearing the land and how you're like in areas where it's like soaked with malaria-infused mosquitoes. And I'm thinking, oh, this is not, these are not exactly good places to go live and to work, right? Like this is, it's helpful to kind of get a like, oh, this is real stuff and real organizing. But you end up, you have relationships like Whitfield and Williams where they end up kind of supporting each other. And then you also have the reality that comrades stab us in the back. They break our hearts, movements fracture. Maybe it's a tragic comic story, right? Maybe it's one that has these huge successes, but then is overarchingly one that's sad. How then do you talk? I want to get to, Eric, your point here around, you know, conditions today. But how do you tell the story to people? Like, why should they care about this? Why should they care about the Southern Tenants Farmers Union now? Why should they care about Williams and Whitfield? They ended up like betraying each other in a way. I mean, not Whitfield and Williams specifically, but
I think you should care because The story of Whitfield and Williams raises a fundamental question that I think many people have today and then, which is like, when you see fundamental injustice exist in society, what do you do? How do you act in an ethical way to do something to rectify that situation? Or do you just, you know, sort of try to withdraw from society or ignore it? And here's a case where a number of people found in Christianity a way to directly confront the injustices of their time in a powerful way. In so doing, you know, they developed an ecumenical form of anti-institutional religion that powered them through decades worth of really amazing forms of activism and creativity. I would even go so far as to call them organic intellectuals, and that they both were educated, as well as, you know, their cohorts in different degrees, but that they, through experience and through reading and through all these different modes of conversation, you know, that were going on in these campfire meetings, were developing their as personalities. And they really lived life deep and hard, right? They found great meaning and reward in that struggle. And I think that's important to understand as well. Why should we care? Well, I mean, again, like I think thinking about evangelical religion today and the idea that, oh, all evangelicals are a certain way and they're all very conservative and individualistic, et cetera. Here you have this example in the Great Depression and World War II era, a very left-wing kind of evangelicalism that has a great kind of cultural resonance too. I think it's not just a footnote, for example, that you get the development of the Almanac Singers, Woody Guthrie, Pete Seeger, this kind of culture of labor and proud working class people out of this ethos. So all of those things, I think, have a huge influence on how we think about how we can think about the 20th century in terms of working class religion and belonging, how to sustain and engage in protest movements when you think the world and, you know, is being unfair, right? And you know, there's this great moment in the book that we discuss, who am I to say whether it was real or not, when Owen Whitfield like has almost lost it, right? And he has this religious experience where God comes to him and says, I'm filling many, many barns. And if you're not getting your share of that, that's your fault. You got to go get it. Powerful stuff. And I think that's, you know, it speaks to our own time just as much as it does that earlier period in the 20th century.
You know, they're both willing to go to the places no one else wants to go, right? So Williams really, after he's at Vanderbilt, he's dissatisfied with the life of a itinerant preacher who's got these churches. Maybe he's going to get a permanent assignment in a bigger church. And this by, you know, the end of the 1920s is empty. So he takes an opportunity to go to a coal mining community in Western Arkansas, where the church is empty. There's no preacher, essentially as a domestic missionary for the Presbyterian Church. And he takes that assignment, does great things there, like when he notices that the pool hall is more popular than the church, he gets a pool table for the church, right? Let's just bring the pool hall into the church, and it works, right? Which ruffles feathers and ultimately is one step among many that gets him fired from that job, which is a, you know, another common theme in the story for Claude Williams is getting fired from various institutions. But Whitfield the same, like they're committing their lives to struggle in hostile places among people that have been given up on and are despised and that no one else wants to go. And I think that today, you know, as someone who's in a similar position, maybe, you know, you're thinking society is unjust. There are vast swaths of the country, you know, red state America, if we're thinking from a progressive political side, who's going there, right? Who's trying? Who's doing the work? These lives provide powerful, compelling examples of people who did the work, actually did a lot of good that can be measured over time. We can point to things, but won impressive gains with the help of the people they went to minister to.
Eric, you talked a little bit, and this is important here, and Jared, you're just referencing this sort of anti-institutional religion. Both of you mentioned people should care about Williams and Whitfield because they almost reading your book, it's almost like, or studying their lives is like picking up a toolkit for thinking creatively around organizing strategies today. I've been looking at how it is that they brought people together, what the processes of education were, how they thought about the relationship between class and race. Let's talk a little bit more about those two things. Let's talk about what you mean by anti-institutional religion. I'm just curious about that.
I should say that on that topic, you know, it's one example of how our work, this book, The Gospel of the Working Class, is not a hagiography of these two individuals and this cast of characters. I mean, there are many times in the story where I was just so frustrated with Williams and Whitfield. Like, why can't you be a better institutionalist in this moment? Do you always have to have a kind of larger religious principle that if it gets even a little bit violated, you leave, right? And, you know,
I just want to be like, yes, I read the book and honestly, I put it down. I didn't like Williams anymore. I was like, you know what? He sounds like he's just kind of going to do his own thing. He's not, he's owned his own club and he's not a team player is how I felt about it.
There's a point, I think Williams, because of the frustrations of his life, gets to a point where he starts becoming like some of the demagogues he opposes, right? And I think one key moment in the book is like during the war, he's in Detroit and he starts opposing Reverend Gerald L.K. Smith, right? Disciples of Christ minister, et cetera. And some of the things Williams does and says are like a little too close to mimicking the things that he hates in Gerald L.K. Smith in terms of the other side, which is like a kind of religion, a warped religion that's preaching a kind of, I think it's really fascinating how these guys are anti-institutionalists, but maybe sometimes they go too far. I do think there's value, though, in anti-institutional types of religion and politics. I mean, on the political side, it's amazing how, you know, there's this point where like Claude Williams writes a funding letter appeal to the head of the Socialist Party and the head of the Communist Party and says basically the same thing, right? And so...
Well, no, not basically. Like, I think there's a fundraising where the differences are crucial. He's like, oh, we can use this organization to help the, you know, the communists.
Right, right.
So he's very strategic in playing this out, right. I think. If I'm
like anyone who writes a grant proposal, right? You tailor the basic template to the needs of the granting agency.
That's right.
And that's essentially what Williams is doing. And that's what gets him expelled from the Southern Tenant Farmers Union, because Kester, who is an institutionalist, who is a kind of born administrator, can't bear his one-time good friend, who's this absolute maverick when it comes to institutional loyalty, who sees the mission is more important than the vehicle, right? And he's willing to switch vehicles. Kester, right, I think, is more of an institutionalist.
And that, I mean, I think one thing is clear to me here. Your point, Jared, is it feels right. Other figures who were in the same time and organizing in the same places as Williams and Whitfield, like Howard Kester, were more institutional loyalists. But it does strike me that Whitfield and Williams were damn good organizers. Mm-hmm. And so they knew how to bring people together to form coalitions. So in the sense that they're anti-institutional, it seems to me that they're only anti-institutional only to the extent that loyalty to the institution above the cause. And so then it's like, well, no, of course I'm not going to be like, no, I'm going to follow the cause as opposed to this institution. I think I want to make that point because part of one of the problems, at least when we're talking with people today around religion and organizing and things like that, is you get the anti-institutionalists and they think, well, I'm just going to be an individualist then. And it's like, no, that's not the point. The point is still to bring people around common causes and issues and values to build collective economic and political power. You know, that is crucial. Without that, you don't win.
That's great, Aaron, because I think that's really important to emphasize. I wouldn't want the listeners of this podcast to assume that because they're anti-institutionalists, they were individualists. Because if anything united both Whitfield and Williams and all the people around them, like Winifred Chappell and Howard Kester and these other, they were collective. I mean, they did everything in the collective, right? And they understood that that's where power resided, but they also understood that that's kind of those loving relationships, those you know, bonding relationships were just like so crucial to sustaining their work and you know, living their lives in a rewarding way.
I love that. I mean, that's profound right there. I mean, that's the stuff that gets you through, right?
And we're able to get to some of that through the archival record with correspondence between Whitfield and Williams. There's a period during the war where they're kind of cut off from each other and haven't heard from each other and are kind of concerned about how the other one's doing, and then come back together toward the end of the war. And there's correspondence between Zella and Joyce as well, because they shoulder the burden on the other side of being married to these two people, right? Having to run households, having to, you know, in Zella's case, you know, running a farm, looking after children, also organizing in their own right. But they're the true institutionalists in their families, holding them together while Williams and Whitfield are going all over the country, risking their lives, making decisions that threaten financial stability, threaten a paycheck, which is a good reason to be attached to an institution, is that they often give you paychecks, right? But if you keep getting fired, that puts more burden on your family. And so we're able to get to some of that with the documentary record, which was really great.
Jared and Eric, this has been such a rich conversation. I want to sort of wrap up here with a final question, you know, returning to where we started, back to YouTube. Eric, you talked about the rich, collaborative, you said loving relationships. The Academy prizes individualists. It builds and structures scholars to be alone in the library. This is my, I'm going to like be hyperbolic here. Lonely late nights in the library is the road to success. But you guys have collaborated. And it seems to me in fields that don't necessarily reward collaboration. Why?
That's a great question, Aaron.
I mean, I think in our case, it was because we couldn't understand the whole story without having the other person, right? That historians so often like to try to organize the past in these boxes, and that the characters in the story, in terms of their religion, in terms of urban and rural, in terms of their race, they don't fit in any of those categories, right? They go outside those boxes. And so we needed each other to be able to write this. And fortunately, it was a really great collaborative effort that was very rewarding. I mean, I remember writing the introduction on like some kind of strange, small laptop.
I had a tiny laptop. Oh, yeah. A tiny laptop that was, you know, just a little bit bigger than the palm of my hand.
Oh, my God.
We were leaving Dearborn, Michigan, having just done some last research at the archive at Wayne State.
Yeah.
And I think I was on my way to drop Jared off at the airport or something, and he's furiously typing on this little tiny
in the passenger seat. Yeah.
You know, you never know when the big epiphanies are just going to happen, right?
That's
and they
right.
happen right then. And, you know, and of course, our current project about the United Cannery and Agricultural and Packing Workers of America, the Yukapawa, is even a more giant collaboration where we have four main authors and editors and then 12, 15 other historians involved.
Wow.
And that collaboration has also been rewarding, but it also is just sometimes it's just tearing my hair out in frustration, because that's a lot of cooks in the kitchen, right? Overall, I would say like academics have to be, you know, have to get out of that framework of being so individualistic and sort of goal oriented, right? Really, you know, I think studying some of these historical characters has led me to understand that history doesn't have to be that way, right? It can be a collective enterprise, and that's really, it matters, and it's more rewarding that way too.
Yeah, I mean, you know, what you gain from sharpening each other's analysis, challenging each other's readings and assumptions, working together to try to solve something that maybe doesn't make sense at first blush is really, it's not just, you know, two times the mental power brought to bear, the expertise, but I think there's a kind of exponential factor in what you're able to learn and see in the sources and patterns you're able to find by working together in close collaboration, and then trying to write a seamless, coherent narrative that's in one voice when there are two voices. Two voices are the inputs, and one voice has to be the output, and that's a challenge, but a fun intellectual one.
I can't imagine doing that, let alone with what you said, 12 or 13 other authors here. This is other contributors here. This is a big, but it sounds like an exciting project you guys are working on now.
Yeah. CIOs, agribusiness, Union and National History, UCAPAWA, and then FTA, or its acronyms. The acronyms, the real names are so long, it would take the whole podcast to say them. But from the 1930s through the 1950s and its aftermath, a national history that takes us from canned salmon workers in Alaska to sugar beet workers in Colorado to cotton workers in the South to Campbell Soup workers in New Jersey.
And I love that. I want to wrap up here, but I think that that's what I love about what you guys are pursuing now is this is deep to the heart of the Wetland Cook program too, which is questions around how exploitation of land and exploitation of people, expropriation of land and expropriation of people are always interconnected. So Jared, you talk about how it is that people literally tore down forests in order to make sharecropping. And it's really transforming the land of northeastern Arkansas and southeastern Missouri here. Just the land wasn't empty. And so the attention to that is also really, really important for thinking about how it is that we are with each other and in the world.
Yeah, especially today, right? There's no perhaps more pressing crisis today than the climate crisis.
And you have to build people power in order to confront it.
Yeah, and certainly it's about environment, but also it's about a kind of forgotten working class, like a working class below the working class. And I think, you know, who puts the food on our table? Who picks the strawberries and all the produce? And who processes that stuff? How does it get to your table and to your supermarket, right? These are the same questions that this union was trying to answer in the 30s and 40s. And they had this ambitious idea that what if we organized these workers that nobody else wanted to organize up and down the commodity chain? And if you could accomplish that, then you could actually have real power to leverage against all of those forces of exploitation that I think people can relate to in this moment, right? Those people were exposed as those frontline workers during the pandemic. I think it's an urgent kind of history that's part of, you know, that's in part inspired by a kind of working class religious ethos.
Jared and Eric, thank you so much for your time. This has been a lot of fun. We'll be sure to keep our eyes out for the forthcoming book. What's the working title?
Is it From Farm to Factory still?
There you go. It's very early then.
Here America's most ambitious labor union, civil rights labor union.
Oh,
yeah. It's not that far from coming out, but this is part of the process of co-authorship. Here's where Eric and I and other people, Max Crockmull, Sarah McNamara, the other two main co-authors, need to sit down and hammer out a title.
The easiest part, right? Goodness.
Thanks so much, Aaron. I mean, it's been really so nice to revisit this book that Jared and I wrote together, you know, and the themes in it. And I'm just as passionate about these themes that I was, you know, 10 years ago.
Yeah, you all knocked it out of the park. I know we moved quickly. Thank you so much for your time and your energy.
Thanks, Aaron. It's been a pleasure.
As we conclude this insightful journey into the social gospel in the South, we extend our gratitude to Aaron, Eric, and Jared for their expertise and engaging conversation. If you found this episode compelling, head over to religionandjustice.org for more on our grant series. Remember to subscribe wherever you find podcasts, share your thoughts, and connect with us on social media. Despite the absence of our usual banter, George and I hope you've enjoyed this unique episode. We'll be back for the next one with more explorations at the intersections of religion, justice, and history. Until next time, I'm one of your hosts, Gabby Lisi, and together, we navigate the path to justice.